Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, I think secularism is the middle ground, really. At the extremes of the discussion about religion and politics are, you know, theocracy on the one hand, that says my religion is true, it shouldn't just govern my life, it should govern the life of the nation completely, and should be enforced, you know, throughout law and so on and so forth. That's one sort of extreme. And the other extreme, I think, well, in some ways it's the flip side of the coin, but the other extreme in practice, in relation to religion and politics, is the sort of thing that perhaps we see in North Korea today, that we've seen, or China, that we've seen in the past in places like the Soviet Union or Albania or Cuba in the past, that says, you know, there can be no involvement of religion in social or political life. Religion ought to be, you know, stamped out. Religion is a lie, and materialistic atheism should be the doctrine of the state and the nation. And, you know, I think secularism says no to both those extremes, and tries to create perhaps not a middle ground but a common ground, where people who have equal citizenship in a shared nation, in a shared state, can pursue their own choices and freedom of religion or belief, but also will give respect to other people's choices and not seek to use the state to impose their views on their fellow citizens in matters where they don't agree. So I think secularism, within the terms of your question, actually does offer that middle ground.
The rules of our morality are not the conclusions of our reason. The provocative words of Scottish philosopher, essayist and historian David Hume. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Does Europe need to open up to ideas on a secular state? And is religion a private matter? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to tackle those questions with Andrew Copson, the chief executive of Humanists UK, whose latest book, Secularism, Politics, Religion and Freedom, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Andrew argues, even in a world of diversity, we need a framework for our common life. And most of us want a framework to be a fair one. So, what is secularism? How do we define it? And where does it fit in our complex and religiously divided world?
Hello, my name is Andrew Copson. I'm the Chief Executive of Humanists UK and President of the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And my latest book is called Secularism, published by Oxford University Press, about politics, religion and freedom.
Really well done on the book, Andrew. It's a very illuminating read and very measured, I might add, too, which always helps. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can play it by ear from there. Is humanism an attitude to life, do you think, kind of an intellectual direction of sorts or a way of looking at the world?
I think, well, the word humanism, as we use it today, describes a set of values and beliefs which together make up a coherent approach to life, a worldview. And, you know, many long books of multiple volumes have been written about exactly what that humanism means. But I think, you know, minimally, it's an approach to life that says that this universe is a natural phenomenon. There's no second layer to it where there might be gods or goblins or ghosts or whatever. That our morality doesn't come from outside humanity, but from inside ourselves, and that we have to make our moral choices in the here and now, in the context that we find ourselves in, not by following rules or commandments or authority. And that in the absence of any discernible meaning or purpose to the universe, it's human beings in our lives that make meaning ourselves and together. And that sort of this-worldly approach to life, prizing welfare and fulfillment of human beings and other animals, of course, that can also suffer, is what the word humanism really indicates today.
And on a personal level, what does that mean in terms of your daily experience of life? How does being a humanist change how you live in the world or how you react to certain conditions in the world?
Well, I was brought up a humanist by a humanist mother and humanist grandparents, so I don't quite know how it would be different from anything else. I've got no big sort of conversion story to say how my life changed when I came into these beliefs. I've always had them. But what it does certainly is, I suppose, it makes me very mindful of our responsibilities. You know, I don't think that there's any sort of salvation for us from outside this planet and this humanity. So I think that, you know, humanist attitude personally for me makes me very mindful of my responsibilities, our bigger responsibilities. I think it also makes me feel very connected both to other people, you know, who we're all part of the same human family, literally, biologically, that's true. And I think also it makes me feel connected more to this planet. I mean, I think, you know, lots of religious people think that sort of human beings are very special, you know, essential creation by some god or whatever. But for me, I think that the fact that we're the product of this planet, of this environment, of nature, that's the sort of specialness that I see in human beings. And so I feel sort of very at home in this world, very much caring about what happens to it in the future, and very connected to other people and very aware of my sense of responsibility, I think. I think that's how it affects my life anyway.
So tell me, Andrew, has secularism always been controversial, do you think?
Yeah, secularism certainly always has been controversial. So by secularism, obviously, we mean the separation of religious institutions from state institutions and the maximising of freedom of conscience for people, the state not telling them what to think and believe and so on. And of course, that's always been extremely controversial in the past and also today. Governments, monarchs, of course, but also any sort of government, even democratic governments, quite often do want to tell people what to think, tell people what to believe, control people in various ways. And religious institutions almost always want to do the same. And so there's a great temptation for religious institutions and state institutions to get into bed with each other and to mix themselves up together, because that obviously maximizing their power. And when people start getting opposed to that, when they organize to oppose that, when they have revolutions, as we've seen in the history of, especially in the West, but all over the world, to try and separate church and state or religion and state, then of course that's controversial because people in power want to keep it. And one of the ways that they've learned power can be best exercised is if you can control not just people's bodies, but their minds. And that's what, non-secular states try to do. So secularism as a way of increasing freedom, as a liberation, as an empowerment of ordinary people to make the choices that perhaps state and church don't want them to make, has been controversial for that reason.
You write in your introductions, this book is not intended as an argument for secularism, but as an introduction to it. And you preface it by saying something on the lines of religion and politics are notoriously, two topics, that can be quite divisive in polite company. So how do you see it all?
Well, I mean, this book is intended to be an informative and balanced introduction, as you say. I mean, obviously, I am a secularist personally. I think that a secular state is the best way to treat religion and politics in the cause of freedom. But the starting point for writing the book was that it should be an objective, as far as possible, objective and informative introduction to the topic, rather than that it should be an argument for secularism. And I think the reason why a balanced introduction to the topic was needed is because secularism is a concept today that around the world is under threat, and it's under threat in the same way that democracy is under threat or human rights are under threat more generally. But unlike democracy and human rights, secularism isn't really very well understood. It doesn't feature on school curriculums, even when studying politics. It doesn't even feature really on many university curriculums where politics is being studied. So secularism is sort of unknown, and that means that there's a double threat to it, because not only is it under attack, like other liberal concepts that I've just mentioned, it's also very poorly defended because many people don't understand it, don't know about it, and so on and so forth. So the book was intended really to inform readers who maybe want to know more clearly what secularism just is, because they haven't got an idea at the moment. And I think that's why it includes chapters, of course, that give the arguments against secularism as well as the arguments in favour of secularism. And I hope that people will read it and come to their own view, and that by defining secularism, by talking about it clearly, it'll just help us have more focused and intelligent and friendly conversations about it.
Well, does secularism mean essentially neutrality, or is that a bit misguided? Because some people would see it as essentially this kind of fair play, neutral position on all religious matters. But that's not really what it is. Sure, it's not.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, the secular state is not just sort of completely vacuous, you know, completely neutral on everything. The secular state has clear policy aims. And in the book, I use a definition of secularism and the secular state that's given by the French academic Charles Babereau. And he says that secularism has three parts. So the first part is the separation of religious institutions from state institutions and no domination of one set of institutions over the other. And that's the part that, you know, most people recognise. The second part, though, is just as important, and it's about the state trying to guarantee as much freedom of thought and conscience and religion and belief for its citizens as possible. Of course, these things are always limited by the rights and freedoms of others, but as much freedom in that area of life as is possible. And the third aspect is that the state should treat people equally, regardless of their religious or non-religious worldview. So separation, freedom, and equal treatment really are the different aspects of secularism. Now, you know, a state that actively wants to maximise freedom, actively wants to achieve equality, is not neutral. It's taking a very firm position on those important topics. Where I think the false charge of attempted neutrality comes from is because secularism does try not to be neutral, but to sort of raise the state above the level of religious controversy. Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the presidents of the United States, one of the founding fathers, a secularist, he was asked what view he thought the state should take of religious controversies, religious conflicts, and he said that what the state should do is ignore them. And that's what the secular state really tries to do. It tries to just lift it, not take a side in the sort of religious sectarian controversies that might be matters of social debate, and where people might divide socially. But, you know, we don't want things to divide politically, because if they divide politically and if the state takes a side, then, of course, we risk exclusion, sectarianism, discord. The history of Europe shows civil war even.
Yeah, and then if you look at what happened in Turkey then and look at the present state, it all becomes particularly miserable, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the consequence, you know, one of the biggest arguments for secularism, actually, I mean, there are lots of philosophical, intellectual arguments for secularism about freedom and rights and so on. But one of the most obvious arguments for secularism is, you know, we can all see what happens when it's not there. You know, we can all see what happens when societies become divided along sectarian lines, when, you know, human rights to freedom of conscience and so on are violated. You get a spiral of oppression, you know, social disharmony, and like you say, you see in Turkey what happens there. Society can split down the middle and things can become very violent very quickly.
Andrew, you bring up a very interesting project. It's called the Religion and State Project, based out of Israel by a guy called Jonathan Fox. And he has analysed and categorised and, I suppose, described religions in, I think, about 177 countries. Mm. And he feels very strongly that, you know, secularism is in a very precarious state around the world. And it's not just in these fault-line countries. Do you agree with him on that?
Yes, I think there are some problems with Fox's methodology. Sometimes what he counts as religious freedom, I wouldn't count as the same thing. But what his great achievement is to have created an enormous index, essentially, a set of measurements that tell us not just how much religious freedom, how much freedom of conscience there is in a country in law, but how much there is in practice, because he analyses, as well as laws, you know, policies and state attitudes across various different areas like education, you know, public law and so on. And what he demonstrates, I think, you know, pretty unambiguously and irrefutably, is that if there's been any change in the last 10 years since he's created this index and the scores for different countries very recently, and 10 years before that as well. And what he tracks over the course of that decade is that if there's been any change in the world, it is away from secularism. So there have been a few isolated incidents of some countries becoming more secular. Fiji, for example, Nepal, Iraq to some extent. But often they're countries that were already very secular anyway, like Sweden, for example, which is one of the countries that in that 10-year period became more secular. And far more countries than that have become less secular. And in general, even countries, you know, where things were already quite non-secular have become even less so. So what Fox's work demonstrates, and like I say, pretty, I think, irrefutably, is that in the real world, in the states of the real world, there is a very low level of secularism generally. Now, I mean, to some extent, of course, we know that. We know that secularism is an ideal, and we know that there is no state in the world that has perfectly achieved separation and freedom and equal treatment. But in the past, certainly in the 20th century, I think a lot of people would have assumed that although that was the case and we don't live in a perfect world, the movement was towards secularism, and that the future would be of more secular states than we had in the past. And what Fox's work demonstrates is that that's not the case.
Andrew, you pitch up a very interesting question. You ask, does a secular presumption disguise religious assumptions? Will you tell me?
Well, it is a very good question, and I think it's one that I'm undecided on myself. The claim of many people who are critics of secularism, especially sort of Western liberals who are critics of secularism, is that while secularism claims to be objective, claims to be a framework that can contain citizens within a state of all different religions and beliefs, in fact, it's full of implicit biases and prejudices that are down to its historical origins. So these critics of secularism say, on a big level, for example, they say secularism is a product in broad terms of a Christian culture, and after that, a sort of humanist enlightenment culture from the 18th century onwards. And that culture is unshared by everyone in the world today. And because secularism is a product of this Christian and then humanist culture, it's therefore unsuitable for everybody, and secularists shouldn't pretend it's universal. And the sort of assumptions they say it contains, which aren't universally shared, are things like the distinction between public and private. So an anti-secularist making this argument might say, secularism assumes that there can be a distinction between public and private, but there are lots of societies in the world where that distinction is either not the same as the one that is developed in the West, or maybe doesn't exist at all. And then there are critics of secularism who will say that secularism assumes that religion is a thing that is separable from politics. And they will say, well, okay, so maybe Christianity and the humanist philosophy of the Enlightenment, can be separable from politics. But in some religions, and they often point to Islam at this point, the belief that it is separable from politics does not exist. And religion is a comprehensive, all-encompassing attitude, not just to life, your personal life and private life and life after death, but also to political life and social life. And so these critics of secularism say that it is, far from being neutral, full of assumptions. Now, I think that's partly true, of course, at the big level. But what these critics often avoid is the truth that secularism is not just a Western construct. Secularism, the biggest secular state in the world is India. And India isn't secular just because it was colonized by Europeans. There are indigenous ideas of separation of religion from politics and equal treatment and freedom of choice that predate Western involvement and interference in India. So it's not true that secularism is wholly a Western construct. Where I think that the critics of secularism who say it's not really neutral and contains biases are onto a bit of a stronger argument is not when they criticize those bigger ideas in secularism, but when they point to perhaps some of the practical issues. Now, this was one of the first tests of American secularism. So in the United States Constitution, there's a clause, part of the First Amendment, that says that the United States won't limit citizens' free exercise of religion. Now, this was tested very early on in the 19th century by Mormons. Mormons who went to court because they had been convicted of the crime of bigamy, and their argument was that they shouldn't be convicted of the crime of bigamy because their religious beliefs said that they should have many wives, more than one wife, and the Constitution guaranteed them free exercise of religion, and therefore who was the state to try and impose what the Mormons said were unshared religious beliefs, Protestant or Catholic religious beliefs, about marriage being between one man and a woman, on them? Why should they, as Mormon citizens, have their free exercise of religion limited to get into line with the religious assumptions about marriage of another group. And I think that that's a far more difficult question for secularists to answer than the bigger ones about, you know, is it just a Western framework and so on and so forth. How do secularists answer them? Well, I think it's important for secularists in answering these critics to admit straight away that secularism isn't perfect. If secularism doesn't pretend to be perfect. In fact, it's part of the argument for it is that it's better than the alternatives. And I think that's an important point for secularists to make. But I think it's also the case that if you look at something like the Mormon example in the United States, it's not necessarily secularism that is preventing Mormons from having more than one wife or Mormon women from marrying the same man. It's more likely these days to be arguments about gender equality or the human rights of others than it is about secularism. If you think of things like the refusal of some bakers to bake a cake that promoted same-sex marriage, some people said, "Oh, look, this is, you know, secularists trying to force their agenda onto Christians." But in fact, again, it wasn't secularism that said that those bakers should bake cakes equally for all people. It was laws on equality for LGBT people. So, you know, quite often it's not secularism that's actually implicated in some of these cases that critics of secularism line up. It's often something else, some other political agenda.
I'm just wondering, how big a challenge is migration to the secularist agenda? I presume it's a pretty heavy challenge considering what we've seen in the last few years.
Yes, it is a heavy challenge, especially, I think, for European states that want to be secular. I mean, I don't think it's such a big challenge for the United States, for example, you know, a country that's sort of built on constant migration and a country where, you know, the Constitution is very much lays out freedom of religion from the beginning. But I think it is a problem for lots of European states. And I think that if you take a state like France, say French secularism, the introduction of French secularism was extremely controversial throughout the 19th century with Catholics, and even in the 20th century was extremely controversial with Catholics. But broadly speaking, by, you know, the mid to late 20th century, most French people, whether Catholic or not, were reconciled to it. They thought that secularism was the best, you know, the secular republic was the best model for them. Now, that, you know, you might argue is pretty easy for a generally homogenous culture to agree to, because although, of course, not, you know, French society is made up at that point of, you know, Catholics and non-Catholics, by and large, you know, they were all ethnically French. Most people were ethnically French. And so the religions that secularism had to deal with were, you know, basically different sorts of Christianity. Now, what migration does is introduces into states that have had very settled patterns of religious and non-religious belonging and belief, introduce into those societies whole new religious dynamics. And it's no surprise, I think, that the secularism of the Republic of France has been most challenged and tested and most controversial since Muslims began to be a significant feature of French society. Now, this is partly, of course, because there are, you know, social and ethnic conflicts when populations change and move. But there are also ideological and intellectual ones. You know, the sort of arguments we were talking a moment ago about why secularism isn't really neutral in the eyes of anti-secularists definitely apply in France, because what is seen as, let's say, a law, let's take the example of the law, the new recent law, that bans signs of, you know, religiosity in public schools in France, state schools. Well, that could be seen as a general law, but obviously it bites down harder on those young people whose religion demands public symbols. Now, if you're a Christian young person and the secular law of your country says that you can't have visible religious symbols, well, that's probably fine, because if you've got anything, you've probably got just a cross on a chain, or, you know, under your shirt or whatever. But if you're a young Muslim woman and you're a young Muslim woman who feels that a headscarf is necessary, not all Muslim women do, of course, but if you're one who does, then plainly the law that prohibits religious symbols, visible religious symbols, is biting down much harder on you in practice than it is on your Christian or Jewish or non-religious contemporaries. And so, you know, that is at the root of it. That is, at the root of that is a problem created by, as you say, migration. Migration offers other challenges to secularism as well, especially today. So what secularism tends to depend on is a feeling of common citizenship amongst people within states that, you know, the secular state that wants to implement these sorts of this sort of equal treatment. Now, one of the things that one of the features of recent migration is that if you think about migration, let's say 100 years ago, let's say into the UK, and when people migrated into the UK about 100 years ago, they basically integrated with the society that was in the UK, and they did that for all sorts of reasons, I'm sure, but one of the big reasons is that having moved to the UK, they had infrequent, if any, contact with the country that they had come from. In today's world, where there are such such globalized communications, not only social media, but also traditional broadcast media that are coming in by satellite from all over the world, and also travel is easier, faster, cheaper, even over long distances. What you get today is even second and third generation migrants from other places still feeling as connected, if not in some cases more connected, to the place that they may never even have been from. You know, it's their grandparents who are from it. But they don't have a complete affiliation with the country of which they are a citizen, the European country of which they're a citizen. And that, of course, is a complication for secularism, because one thing that secularism requires is that everyone should be feeling a sort of a primary nationality to the secular state that is attempting to hold the line. And that's just one example of dozens of issues that migration raises for secularism.
I imagine another complication, Andrew, for secularism would be in relation to medical ethics.
Yes.
Because whether you have a religious disposition or not, or whether you're an atheist or not, or whatever you are, that's a very tricky world to navigate and to give absolutes to. And everyone has a very personal opinion on a law. Let's look at assisted dying, for example.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. I think that assisted dying is one of the easier topics, actually, from the point of view of secularism, because one of the things that secularists want to achieve is freedom of choice for all people, up to the point where it starts interfering with other people's freedom of choice. Now, things like life or death issues, things like abortion or assisted dying, really are all about an individual's choice. And so unless you could make arguments that the availability of assisted dying in law would lead to large numbers of people being coerced into ending their own lives, which is one of the arguments that opponents of assisted dying against the evidence deploy to try and prevent assisted dying being made legal. But unless you believe that, then assisted dying is sort of pretty easy from a secularist point of view, because you would just say, right, well, freedom of choice should be maximized. And therefore, this is something that should be available. And if you don't think assisted dying is good, don't have an assisted death, but let other people who want it do it. The harder issues for the secular state to deal with are ones of conscientious exemption. So when an individual tries to say, according to my conscience, I shouldn't be forced to do this, X, Y, or whatever. So the cases that we've seen, for example, in London of registrars who don't want to solemnise gay marriages, same-sex marriages, or, as we were discussing a moment ago, bakers who don't want to bake cakes for same-sex marriages. It's often about sex, you know, one way or another, this sort of harder choice. In those, or people who don't want, people who want to show their religion in public office, somewhere like France, for example, those sorts of choices are a bit harder. And there, I think that what secularism tries to do is really just strike a balance between the freedom of conscience of the person who wants to claim an exemption or, you know, not be made to do a thing or whatever, and the rights and interests of others. And that's, they can be quite, in real life context, they can be quite difficult lines to draw, balances to strike.
It's not a kind of, there's no kind of clear yes or no in any of that freedom of conscience stuff. Sure,
no.
There's not. You're almost putting a question or a demand on yourself that is next to impossible to answer or next to impossible to qualify, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's no single answer. That's exactly right. And I think I say that in the book, actually, is that these things all have to be discussed in context. I mean, what secularism offers is a framework for addressing the question, but it doesn't offer an automatic answer to the question.
But in a world which is so diverse and with so many different religions and different cultural, I suppose, grouping models of sorts, how can you actually do that? Like, it seems impossible.
Well, it's very hard. I mean, I don't think it's impossible. I think one of the, you know, even in the very intractable areas of public policy and public life, like education, for example, which is an extremely difficult area for secularism, even there, you know, around the world, there are models that are offered of compromise and, you know, pragmatic accommodation that try to address everybody's needs. I mean, the reality is, of course, that everybody's needs will never be addressed in a completely equal way. Because some people want things that simply can't be provided, either practically or because it would have such a disproportionate cost for some other person.
And, you know, dependent on what countries you come from and how you understand your role or position in life and what gives you meaning or purpose, you can make an argument for what is your right.
Absolutely. I mean, anyone can make an argument for everything. And it's even worse than just saying, you know, that there's lots of religious groups and that growing numbers of groups and so on. Because even within groups, even at the individual level, one person's, you know, one Catholic doesn't want exactly the same thing as another Catholic. And, you know, that's true of people of almost every sort of religious or non-religious worldview or cultural approach or whatever. So, I mean, really, diversity is as much a matter of individuals with very different ideas from each other as it is of, you know, groups with very different ideas from each other. But I don't think that's necessarily a counsel of despair, because one of the things that one of the answers that secularism might provide to that is to say, you know, yes, that's right. Individuals do make very different choices, do have very different preferences, do have very different ideas. And that's why the state needs to some extent, sort of back off from interfering in those choices and needs to provide, you know, as much choice and freedom to individuals as possible. And, you know, that's an okay answer, I think, as far as many secularists are concerned.
We're seeing a growth now, Andrew, in Ireland, of humanist services, whether it's funerals, marriages, you know, whatever it is. And I'm just wondering, do you think we'll get to a stage, whether it's in 100 or 200 years' time, do you think that we can look at that there will be such a thing as a post-religious society? Do you think that can actually happen?
Yes, I think so.
Even in America?
Even there. Even in the United States of America. Yeah, and I think it will happen very soon. I mean, already in the UK, a majority of people don't have a religious identity. And in the UK, a huge majority of people don't have religious beliefs. And an even larger majority of people don't engage in any formal religious worship. I mean, it's over 90% of people who don't engage in formal religious worship. In Scotland, humanist marriages are larger every year than religious marriages. The Church of Scotland, Catholic Church in Scotland, they're all outnumbered by the humanist marriages in Scotland. Most people don't want religious funerals now in the UK. And the UK is just one example. I mean, it's one of the least religious places in the world, but other countries, you know, aren't far behind. So I do think that we're, to all intents and purposes, in people's private lives, in the UK at least at the moment, we're living in a post-religious society. It just so happens that in the case of the UK, there's a very powerful established church. So although we're a post-religious society, we're not a post-religious state, you know. So that's still there. But I see no reason why the whole island of Ireland shouldn't, you know, be heading down the same path. And I'm pretty sure that it will do. It may take a little bit longer. It has taken a little bit longer in countries that have been historically Catholic in Europe for you know, social secularization to take hold. But nonetheless, it's happening. And it's even happening in the United States, where younger people in particular are less likely to be religious than older people. And that's a trend that is generational, not age-related. So the future will be post-religious, at least at the on the social level, I would say pretty much across the West in the next 30 to 40 years.
What do you say to the argument, Andrew, that, you know, secularist groups are almost too associated with either people who have a kind of a non-religious worldview or whether it's the atheist community or whatever, that they lack, in essence, a sense of objectivity and they lack that discipline within objectivity because they're too deeply entrenched with the non-religious?
Yeah.
I think it's very credible.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I think this has been a real problem for secularism down the ages. You know, a lot of people who have been very famous political secularists, people like Thomas Jefferson in the United States, people like Ataturk in Turkey, you know, people like the French revolutionaries, the ultra-revolutionaries, or in India, you know, the first Prime Minister of India, people like Nehru. I mean, all of those people have been not just political secularists, but personally non-religious. Or in the case of Ataturk and Nehru, you know, very anti-religious. And so as a result, secularism, political secularism has become too associated with non-religious people. But it also, you know, for every Nehru, there's a Gandhi. I mean, Gandhi was also, together with Nehru, you know, an ardent secularist politically, but you certainly couldn't accuse him of being non-religious, you know. His whole life was a, you know, a religious life, as a life of Hindu devotion. And some of the earliest secularists in Europe were very strongly believing Christians, particularly the Baptists, the Baptist denomination in early modern England and the Netherlands in particular, you know, radical secularists, people who believed in a total separation of church and state. And they believed it for Christian reasons, you know. They wanted to render to God what was God and to Caesar what was Caesar's. And they didn't want God getting involved in Caesar's stuff, and they didn't want Caesar getting involved in God's stuff either. And that was for religious reasons. I mean, one of the things, and there are prescriptions in other religions for secularism as well. You know, when Muslim rulers in India, or even when Muslim secularists today want to make an Islamic case for secularism, they point to those parts of the Quran that says that, you know, there shouldn't be any compulsion in religion, and other religions can point to the same sorts of traditions of secularism in their own cultures and parts of the world. So there is a strong religious case for secularism as much as there is a strong non-religious case for secularism. And in fact, one of the things that I do in the book is try to give, for every non-religious argument for secularism, also some religious equivalents, and they do exist. And you know, no one could accuse the United States of being a non-religious society, but it is a secular state, and the secularity of the state is very earnestly defended, especially by religious people.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Andrew Copson, the Chief Executive of Humanists UK, whose new book, Secularism, Politics, Religion and Freedom, has just been published by Oxford University Press. I asked Andrew, what does he say to people who state they're spiritual but not religious, and whether he thinks that position is just a bit woolly?
Yeah, I mean, the word spiritual is so ambiguous. it can have so many different meanings that if someone says that, my first question is always, what do you mean by it? Because if you Google spiritual, for example, you get everything from the full mass to whale song and crystals. You know, it's pictures of waterfalls or whatever. I don't know. So you know, first thing is to ask for definition. I mean, I don't know what the word spiritual means to most people. For myself, I don't find it a use word, so I don't use it. But if it indicates something, you know, if it's intended to describe the sorts of things in life that take us outside of ourselves, you know, the sorts of things in life where we feel a connection with something, you know, bigger, maybe transcendent, and the sort of thing that we, you know, there's sort of moments of heightened awareness that we have, really, of the sort that we get when we listen to music or, you know, see beautiful things, whether it's in the natural world or in art, or, you know, have a particular memory or read a particular bit of poetry, or, you know, I don't know, look into the eyes of, you know, a child or a grandchild or a pet, or, you know, or whatever it is. I mean, this is one of the problems. These spiritual moments are different for every person. I mean, if it's those sorts of peak experiences that people are describing when they describe themselves as spiritual, then I would just say, well, yes, these are a natural part of being human. And one of the wonderful things about the human species is that we don't just have experiences. We're not just organisms moving through the universe and having things happen to us. You know, we, in our own minds, do give meaning to events. We tell ourselves, you know, a story of our own lives in our head all the time. And this is one of the things it means to be human, is to have these experiences, to make these connections and to give meaning to them and to feel that these things have meaning, to you a sense of purpose and be fulfilled in doing so. And I think that, you know, that's the closest I can ever get to understanding what someone means when they say they've got a spiritual side to them, or they've had, you know, spiritual experiences. And, you know, so far, so humanist.
But it's interesting, Andrew, that, you know, some people would see the secularist political agenda as removing all meaning, you know, social and cultural meaning. And they would see it that, you know, whether it's their religious groups, that it gives them a sense or a feeling of community, and it gives them a sense of meaning and purpose. And
yeah,
then if you
it.
Deny, you know, those social groupings, whether they're cross-generational, that in itself takes away from the soul of the nation, irrespective of whether it's a religious one or not.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, there a lot of people do fear that, and I think it's interesting that you use the word nation in connection with that argument, because anti-secularists who make the argument that, you know, the people need to feel bonded together in some organic way are often nationalists. So there's a good example of Hindu nationalism today in India,
which is very troubling, isn't it?
They're highly troubling, exactly. I mean, it's been a huge movement for many decades. I mean, it's the same movement that inspired the assassin of Gandhi, you know, in the 40s. And this is a movement that is now in power in India. And Prime Minister Narendra Modi is the leader of a Hindu nationalist party. And what inspires them is exactly the sort of romantic, conservative, ethnic nationalism that you've just indicated. You know, they feel that society is not a collection of individuals and families that, you know, might make rational choices and should have freedom to pursue their own ends. But society is instead, you know, a family, a nation, and an organic sort of thing, you know, connected to the soil and to the place and bound together, and only, you know, only can be bound together and kept, you know, coherent and keep its cohesion through a religious belonging. And I mean, this is a common argument of people against secularism, as you just explained. But I think the cost of this cohesion is often the persecution of minorities, which we see in India now. We've seen in countries in Europe that have tried to maintain this sort of ethnic nationalism or sort of romantic, you know, organic approach to society. And the rights of minorities get trampled. The rights of children get trampled to make up their own minds as they grow, rather than to be inculcated, indoctrinated, you know, into a particular confession, a particular religion in most cases. And I think that in general, people's freedom suffers. So it comes down to a choice. I mean, would you rather have freedom and the possibility of everyone being respected in a society that makes space for difference, or would you rather have a nation of conformity, bound together, perhaps very cohesive, yes, but perhaps quite oppressive too?
And last question for you, Andrew. What about the middle ground? Do you think we can get a middle ground in all of this? Because, you know, whether you have a view that, you know, religion should be a private matter, or you feel that, you know, religion and, you know, education or whatever it is, law and governance, whatever, law and order, you know, that it's helpful. Do you think that we should look at an idea of a middle ground?
Well, I think secularism is the middle ground, really. I mean, at the extremes of the discussion about religion and politics are, you know, theocracy on the one hand, that says my religion is true. It shouldn't just govern my life; it should govern the life of the nation completely, and should be enforced, you know, throughout law and so on and so forth. That's one sort of extreme, and the other extreme, I think. Well, in some ways it's the flip side of the coin, but the other extreme in practice in relation to religion and politics is the sort of thing that perhaps we see in North Korea today, that we've seen, or China, that we've seen in the past in places like the Soviet Union or Albania or Cuba in the past, that says, you know, there can be no involvement of religion in social or political life. Religion ought to be, you know, stamped out. Religion is a lie, and materialistic atheism should be the doctrine of the state and the nation. And, you know, I think secularism says no to both those extremes and tries to create, perhaps not a middle ground, but a common ground where people who have equal citizenship in a shared nation, in a shared state, can pursue their own choices and freedom of religion or belief, but also will give respect to other people's choices and not seek to use the state to impose their views on their fellow citizens in matters where they don't agree. So I think secularism, within the terms of your question, actually does offer that middle ground.
That was Andrew Copson from Humanists UK. Secularism, Politics, Religion and Freedom is published by Oxford University Press and retails for in around €14 in hardback. Now, I have to say, this is a very handy little read. It's compact, informative and brilliantly argued. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the hopeful words of Andrew Copson from his conclusions to secularism. Secularism is like every political agenda in that it can be realised in either a liberal or a draconian way. it can be introduced democratically with public consent, subject to the rule of law, carefully implemented in a way that seeks to respect the human rights of those of all beliefs. Thoughtful words indeed. Good night.